to parenting, and do email any questions to us, 9tonoon@radionz.co.nz. Text us to 2101 or tweet us at 9tonoon. Our guests have penned the book Teenagers Translated, How to Raise Happy Teens. The British Councillors turned authors, Janie Downshire and Niala Grew, and they suggest teen misbehaviour is not a conscious choice, but rather can be explained by neuroscience. And depending on how our parents react to their challenges, changes in the teenage brain at this time offer a window of opportunity to mould fluid personalities and nudge them towards more settled behaviour. Niala and Janie are with us by Skype from Wensleydale in the UK's Yorkshire Dales. Great to talk to you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
You're most welcome. Look, you're not scientists at the outset. Your parents, I think, were seven teenagers between you. And how did you come at compiling this research that is being done now into, particularly into the neuroscience surrounding the teenage brain?
Well, we met on a counselling course, and we've both done further studies, not only in psychology, but also in sort of neuroscience and behaviour. And it was from that that we actually compiled a program of training courses in schools to teach teachers about teenagers, to help teenagers themselves to sort of better manage their stresses and emotional ups and downs. And we run a lot of parent programs around the UK. And it was from that that we were actually approached by a literary agent who said, you know, why isn't this in a book? So that's how the book came about.
It is an area, isn't it, that we are learning so much more about the particular wiring of the teenage brain. And I suppose that in itself is not new, but we are learning more and more about how we can influence it. And what would you say are the standouts? What is happening neurologically at this stage of development? Niala, do you want to speak to that?
I think probably one of the most important things that you know, Janie and I would point to is that the kind of redevelopment and the changes that are going on in the brain are to do with the sort of changing pathways and connections. And if we think of those connections as behavioural pathways, which is what they essentially are, the more certain pathways are used, the more they are retained, if you like, by the brain. And pathways that are not used simply sort of atrophy, they die. So if we want to promote certain behaviours, then we need to find ways of encouraging those behaviours to be articulated. Because every time a behaviour is articulated, that pathway is activated. And that pathway, if you like, then goes from a narrow little kind of country road into a four-lane highway. And a four-way line highway is the equivalent of a habit. So one of the things that we find, we've realized is really fundamental, is encouraging the kinds of behavior that you want to see and discouraging the kinds of behaviors that you don't want to see. Because if you discourage it, that pathway dies.
Either that or the immediate response to that is actually it's almost like a sort of a signal for them to do the exact opposite of what you want. So how you go about fostering the behaviour you want is a particular strategy, and we might come to that. But I'm wondering if, before we do, you refer to the particular biochemical and hormonal forces at play in teens. They're at play in all of us, of course, but at this stage of life, what are the key ones for teens that can influence behaviour?
So the key biochemicals at play. Well, I think the two ones that we focus on is cortisol, which is the sort of the stress hormone, as it were, and dopamine, which is basically the biochemical that fuels all the renovations that are going on in the brain at the time during this time. And during this time, you know, does go on actually until the age of 23 or 24. So It is for quite a long period. But dopamine is all about risk and reward and pleasure in the brain. So it's where teenagers start to experiment with things, take risks, do some pretty stupid things, also sort of start getting into addictive type behaviors as well. So it's quite a key biochemical for adults to understand about, and unlocks a whole new understanding behind, teenage behavior and motivation and all the rest of it.
And you refer to these, particularly the cortisol, which we know is the stress hormone, and adrenaline would be another, attached to risk and just to all sorts of activities that teens love. You talk to this about this being the chemicals of the unsettled system. Much of what you're about is trying to develop a more even temperament in teens, right? Even when their body may be working against that. So how do we leap between what's happening in their bodies and happening in the wiring of their brains and the sorts of strategies that you encourage to try and even out that temperament?
How do we do that? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, yeah. What are some of the strategies that you're recommending for parents to try and achieve that?
Right. I mean, one of the simplest ways, really, is to role model to your child the sort of calm, more balanced reactions to things, because their brains are still wiring themselves up. They haven't developed the wiring that goes down into their limbic emotional brain to control the emotional impulses. But via mirror neurons in their brain, they will pick up signals from adults around them, which they will then emulate that way of responding and reacting to something. So, for instance, if you're in a very confrontational situation with a child and having an argument with them, if it escalates, that fuels that unsettled cycle, and it gets more cortisol sort of coursing through the veins, as it were, and that exercises those pathways that Nyla was talking about earlier. Whereas if one doesn't like that confrontation and that escalation, then just responding calmly as an adult in the heat of the moment immediately diffuses that tension and changes the biochemicals and brings about a different, a more measured reaction to things.
Indeed, Nyla, that's what you do in the book. One of the first things you do in the book is to get parents to understand how their own reactor buttons work. That's the starting point to dealing with your teens.
Absolutely. And one of the reasons that we think that is so vital is because once you begin to understand it for yourself, then it's much easier to identify it in your child and then to help your child to identify it for themselves. So once I begin to understand, for example, that one of the things that really sets me off is, lying or laziness or whatever it might be, I then begin to see that, gosh, that makes me react and respond much more than it seems to make somebody else react and respond. So that's definitely one of my triggers. And that's a trigger that pushes me into my unsettled cycle. And that's where I'm sort of not really in control. So once I begin to recognize that for myself, then I can begin to start reading it in my child and helping the child to work out what their triggers are. Because realizing what your triggers are is all about learning how to exercise some sort of management and control of them and over them.
Well, not only that, you're making yourself vulnerable when your trigger is known to your child, because, boy, they know the buttons to push to get the reaction they may well seek.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
So this is strategic.
It is strategic, and realizing what, your triggers are, and it also allows you to to arm yourself a little bit better. So if your child does start some sort of you know, cycle that is a fairly repetitive one with you, then you can begin to think, okay, I'm not going to allow myself to get hooked into this because I know that it's one of my buttons and I know the way that this cycle normally plays out. So I'm going to keep myself outside this. But in order to do all of that, you've got to have some awareness of it.
You talk about the parent stress, the potential for that to lead to emotional contagion in the household, and that's what you're trying to avoid not being sucked into. On the other hand, it's interesting that you say you want to model the kind of reaction that you'd like your teens to have, but there are times to be angry, aren't there? And there are times to express that, and you don't want to go so far over the line that there's never an emotional response that's appropriate. How do you work out where that line is?
This is absolutely not about being sort of soft and cozy and never getting angry or being sad or frustrated or anything else.
Or being repressed for that matter, because you don't want to encourage that either.
Absolutely not. No, it's about showing the appropriate emotion at the appropriate time, but also to the appropriate level. So let's say you've had a very stressed day at work. If you come home and throw all your toys out of the pram because your child spills some milk next to the fridge, then that's obviously not an appropriate expression of anger or frustration. But when they've done something wrong and they've reached the boundary or the limit for you and they've overstepped the mark, then they need to know that. But if you're always getting angry, then they don't really know where that line is. So they need to know, gosh, you know, she is really angry tonight. I must have hit the boundary fence.
You also say apologise if you do overreact. And this is interesting, but apologise if you do overreact and just say, look, I blew off over that sort of thing. And I suppose, does that come back again to your argument that you're trying to model? Ultimately, I mean, you're in very different places, parent and teen, but you're ultimately trying to model the behaviour, the way that you want relationships to be conducted.
Yeah, I think that is exactly the way that we see it. And, you know, apologising is one of the things that people just find so hard to do. I mean, you know, children, teenagers, adults alike, it really is very, very difficult. So finding a way of actually emulating, finding a way of actually demonstrating the way that you want a child to behave and demonstrating what you want them to emulate is just vital. And if we can do that with showing them that it's absolutely okay to apologize when you get something wrong. You know, it's you're not going to apologize the whole time, but you do take responsibility for it. You own it when you get something wrong. And actually, life goes on. The relationship survives. And that's that kind of rupture and repair in relationships that is so vital for children to learn as well, that mistakes are okay. We make mistakes in relationships, and as long as we can actually, you know, take responsibility for our share, that's fine, and we learn and we go on.
You also point out, of course, that they pick up on non-verbal signals very, very successfully as well, so to be strategic about those, particularly in certain situations. You talk about investigative parenting. I'm interested in this, and you also make the point that what they say can be very different from what they're actually thinking or wanting. In fact, it's very common at this time of life, it'll be the exact reverse of what they're thinking or wanting, and you've got to work that out. How do you approach what you call investigative parenting?
Yeah, it's not quite sure.
The chapter I'm talking about here, investigative parenting, before you as a parent can take proactive steps to establish positive personality traits and chapters, it's helpful to take some time to really watch your teenager, really build an awareness of their behavioural, unique behavioural style.
Yeah. I think that what we're meaning there is that it's really important to be very intuitive about your child and to pick up on their non-verbal behaviour as well as what they're telling you, and picking up signals as to whether you, the parent, think your child is okay or not okay. I mean, a lot of the time during the teenage years, you know, suddenly behaviour starts to feel not normal at home, but actually a lot of it is quite normal, and it's quite important to see that, you know, some of it's normal, but some of it falls out of the realms of normal behaviour, and those are the things that we need to pick up on and, you know, be more aware of.
And could I just add to that? I would just also say one of the things that we're talking about when we sort of refer to what you've just quoted is that sometimes children can look as though they are feeling something. So let's say, for example, they look as though they are very relaxed or they're very laid back or they don't care about something, whereas in fact your instinct might tell you that actually that isn't the case. So working on the basis of your instinct and trying to use that to excavate what is going on underneath is really, I think, what we're advocating as well.
You also talk about teenagers having broadly three different responses to perceived threats. They're common ones, fight, flight or freeze. And you give some tips for dealing with each response type. So again, you're wanting to identify which pattern your teenager most commonly engages with. And then how will that affect what your reaction is?
Well, I think by, you know, if you know that you have, you know, as I certainly do, a child who is definitely a fight personality, she will have a tendency when the chips are down to resort to confrontation, answering back, slamming doors, that sort of response. That if I can not match that response, so not shout back at her and flounce around and slam doors, then I'm starting to reduce that sort of excessive reaction, I suppose, fight reaction for her, for when she hits a problem. Because what will tend to happen is when you face any pressures or challenges or difficulties in your life, you're always going to sort of default to a certain sort of behavior pattern. And that's fine. I mean, it's not a problem with doing that. But if that behavior pattern is quite overreactive and oversensitive, and you flick into that quite quickly and quite deeply, then that's a pattern that you want to try and reduce down and have a more balanced reaction to problems during the teenage years is a time to start to put those new patterns and pathways in place.
What do you do with the flight response? Because this is quite common. Teens who just don't want to go there will either physically remove themselves or by other means remove themselves from something you want to deal with or indeed from a confrontation. What are some of the strategies for that?
Well, I think quite often thinking about where the flight response comes from. So, for example, it quite often can be a risk averse thing. It can be a fear related thing. So once you've worked out where you think it comes from, that helps you to work out your sort of strategy. So for example, if it were fueled by, say, fear, a fear of failure or something like that, then what you would do is you would try and reassure that fear. So you would try and work on reassuring the child about the thing that the child is frightened about, and try and offer encouragement and carrots, if you like, for the child to actually give it a go, but within a kind of supported structure. So I suppose what we're saying here is try and address what you think is the underlying feeling behind the flight response. And that underlying feeling in the example that I've given you now is fear. And that's really the thing that needs to be addressed.
Brings us back to what we were talking about earlier, which is interpreting a response that may not look anything like what is actually going on inside. And it's only over time that you can work out what those patterns are with your individual teen. You speak also that a teenager will be in pursuit of dopamine, whether it's through positive pastimes or by going down temptation alley. And I'm wondering, do you recommend talking to teenagers about how their own brain chemistry works? Is that going to be useful as a sort of a self-awareness tool?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, that's, you know, we go into schools a lot, and part of their sort of social emotional learning program, we would say that you know, learning about your brain is a way for teenagers to start to develop some self-awareness and a sort of beginning of sort of finding their own brake pedal or their moral compass, whatever one wants to call it, by having a better understanding of that bit of their brain that does seek pleasure and risk-taking. And that's all very healthy, and that's good. You know, we want our children that, you know, there's going to be a natural need for them to feel confident enough to take the risk to leave home, to move out into the wider world, to start to experiment with new things, novelty, curiosity. All of that is really important. So, you know, we think it is important that they do that. But we also need to understand that the flip side of motivation and curiosity and excitement is addiction. And, you know, there are an awful lot of places where the addiction pathways can get set up in the teenage brain, whereas what should be being set up is the natural curiosity and the need to take risks and move further afield. And, you know, with computers and, you know, with, you know, substances, you know, alcohol, drugs, eating disorders, all of those sorts of things, you know, they're fueling the dopamine as well.
You also talk about, speaking of new media, because that's obviously, well, the scale and ubiquitous of new media is probably stronger with this generation than most of its predecessors, if not all of its predecessors. And you make the point that the brain can seek sublimation in these media if things around them are stressful. In other words, they may retreat to them. You don't use them anyway, right? But it can become a form of retreat from stress.
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely right, and you know, when we see teenagers individually in our sort of role as counsellors, you know, one of the common areas of retreat, particularly by teenage boys, is in the whole world of gaming, which is an avoidance strategy. It's a sort of trying to take themselves out of what might not be a very pleasant reality and into a sort of rather thrill-seeking sort of other reality, if you like. But the trouble with the sort of high that they get from that is that it's highly addictive. And gaming, you know, as you know, is one of the fastest growing addictions around at the moment. So yes, that kind of seeking solace in that whole world of technology is a really very difficult thing at the moment.
Thanks, both of you. Jenny Downshire and Naila Grew. The book is A Teenager's Translated: How to Raise Happy Teens.